This is the Middle East Monitor podcast from the Voice of America. I'm Paul Westfeeling in the VOA News Center in Washington. Secretary of State Kerry is preparing for a visit to Turkey this weekend. We'll have a report on what he'll be discussing. Egyptian President Morsi and his counterpart from Sudan meet to discuss future relations between the two countries that were once one. And the United Nations says it is running out of money to help refugees from the conflict in Syria. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. I'm Paul Westfeeling in the VOA News Center in Washington. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is due to visit Turkey this weekend as part of his trip to the region. Syria is expected to be high on the agenda, as well as the ongoing efforts to mend relations between Turkey and Israel. Dorian Jones fills us in with this report from Istanbul.
According to State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland, Mr. Kerry will be seeking to build on the current rapprochement efforts between two key U.S. allies.
By going to Istanbul first to see Turkish officials and then going on to Israel, the secretary will also have an opportunity to spur both sides to continue to take steps to deepen their normalization and to work well together.
Last month, Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan accepted an apology from his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, for the 2010 killings by Israeli commandos of nine Turks aboard a ship seeking to break Israel's economic blockade of Gaza. Israel has also agreed to pay compensation to the victims' families. For its part, Ankara has agreed to take steps to unfreeze diplomatic relations, a process observers say Secretary Kerry will be looking to expedite. Semih Yediz, diplomatic columnist for the Turkish newspaper Taraf, warns rapprochement efforts will not be easy.
There won't be much love in this relationship because I think that from the Israeli perspective, they look on the present government as being Islamic and fundamentalist. And on the other hand, from the Turkish Erdogan and AKP perspective, they look on Israel as oppressors of Palestinians and generally being anti-Islamic and all that. But then there's the practicality of the issue vis-a-vis Syria, forcing them to sort of push this ideological orientation to the background because the situation on the ground requires that they look beyond that.
Idiz points out that the governments of Israel and Turkey, both of which share a border with Syria, have called for international intervention in the Syrian conflict. Soli Özel, a lecturer at Istanbul's Kadir Has University, points out Ankara's strong support for the Syrian opposition against President Bashar al-Assad means there is potential for Turkey and Israel to work closely together.
Turkey has already insinuated itself in the Syrian matter. It wishes to be at the forefront and to make sure that the new regime in Syria is not one that is going to be detrimental to Israeli security concerns or even Turkish security concerns. I think these two can actually cooperate. And whether they would cooperate operationally, I don't know yet. It depends on how long this thing goes on.
Syria is expected to be a key issue in Secretary Kerry's talks with his Turkish counterpart. Ankara is likely to press for arming the Syrian opposition. Reviving the stalled negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel is also likely to be on Mr. Kerry's agenda during his visit to Istanbul. Diplomatic columnist Adiz says the thawing of relations between Turkey and Israel makes it possible for Ankara to play a positive role in those efforts.
Now that it's talking to all the sides, there is a potential for Turkey to play a role. And I think personally that Israel would also want this because Turkey can use a moderating influence on Hamas, for example.
The Turkish government has close ties with the Hamas leadership. But international relations expert Özel warns those close ties means the current rapprochement efforts between Turkey and Israel is vulnerable to any outbreak of violence between Israel and the Palestinians.
Let's not say hostage, but dependent on what goes on in the West Bank. They cannot turn their back to the Palestinians if, or maybe when, the third intifada erupts. If there is an intifada and the Israelis brutally suppress it, it's going to be very difficult for the Turkish government to maintain civil relations.
But, Özel points out, there are also powerful economic considerations that could drive rapprochement efforts between Israel and Turkey. Israel is reported to be looking at Turkey as a route for distributing newly discovered natural gas to the lucrative European market. That fits well with Ankara's bid to become an energy hub to the region. something observers say Secretary Kerry will be keen to point out during his visit to Istanbul. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
The President of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, has met with Sudanese leaders in Khartoum, and he's vowing to solidify ties between the two countries, which, at one time, were united. What they discussed and what they plan to do, reported by Edward Duranian from the VOA Bureau in Cairo.
President Morsi received applause from a crowd of worshippers at a mosque in Khartoum, where he addressed them following Friday prayers. It was Mr. Morsi's first visit on a tour of countries with which Egypt shares a land border. He told his audience that he intended to reopen that long-closed land border in several places to strengthen what he termed unity between the two countries.
وإنما نحن الآن إن شاء الله إلى الغد ماضون وطن واحد.
He says that Egypt and Sudan are one nation, share one Nile River, one sense of purpose, and one leadership with the same goals. He insists that Egypt wants what he calls the Nile axis of world development between the Arabs, Islam, and Africa to be a source of rebirth, but that this cooperation and unity is not aimed against anyone. Mr. Morsi said Egypt and Sudan have agreed to reopen road links between them to the east of the Nile, and that ultimately that would lead to reopening other roads between the two countries to join the manpower and production capacities of both nations. The Egyptian president told businessmen earlier in a joint meeting with Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir that he wanted to increase investments between the two countries. Veteran Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qasim says that Mr. Morsi's previous trips abroad have not been overly successful, and that it was not clear exactly what he intended to accomplish by visiting Sudan.
It's the zero-sum foreign policy. None of his international visits has amounted to anything. He goes to China, claiming that it's going to balance out American influence in the region. Do you think China will risk meddling in the area of influence of the United States? And now we see him going to Sudan. He's talking about increasing trade and investments, etc. What are we going to increase the trade in? Cayenne pepper and camels and goats?
Qasim says one major issue that concerns both countries is the long-standing demand from Nile Basin states for Egypt to reduce its share of water from the river. But he says there are people far better qualified than Mr. Morsi in the Egyptian military and intelligence community to negotiate the issue. Both Egypt and Sudan were once united under the Egyptian monarchy. Khartoum gained formal independence in 1956. The two countries have had rocky relations since an attempt to assassinate former President Hosni Mubarak in Addis Ababa in 1995. The Egyptian press accused Sudan of being responsible for the attempt. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Warning from the United Nations Children's Fund. The organization says it will have to scale back on aid for tens of thousands of Syrian refugees in Jordan if it doesn't get any new funding. UNICEF says the consequences of that will be devastating, especially for children. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Zaatari camp in Mafraq, Jordan, houses around 100,000 refugees. More than half are children. The UN Children's Fund provides the camp with water, sanitation, immunization, education, and child protection. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says many of these critical programs are under threat because of agency funding shortfalls.
In concrete terms, this means that by June, we will stop delivering 3.5 million liters of water every day to Zaatari camp. Jordan, by the way, is the world's fourth most water-scarce country. So summertime is going to be particularly intense. This means we won't be able to open the third school we are building at Zaatari simply because we don't have the funds to cover the teacher salaries, the textbooks, the furniture, and the running costs of the school. It means UNICEF will not be able to provide water, sanitation, education, immunization, and nutrition support to two new camps that are slated to open in the coming weeks.
The number of Syrian refugees fleeing into Jordan and other neighboring countries is on the rise. Since the beginning of the year, the United Nations reports more than 2,000 refugees have been crossing the border every day. UNICEF says it expects these numbers to more than double by July and triple by December. By the end of the year, the agency estimates there will be 1.2 million Syrian refugees in Jordan, about one-fifth of its current total population. Mercado says the Zaatari camp population of 100,000 is a fraction of the Syrian refugee population in the country.
Around 80% of Syrian refugees are hosted by local communities, putting an enormous strain on the economy and infrastructure, including on water, health, and education systems. Here, too, UNICEF is providing critical assistance, but needs have far surpassed funding resources. This year, we've only received about 19% or $12 million of the $57 million we've asked for the first 6 months of this year for UNICEF Jordan.
Earlier this year, nations attending an international conference in Kuwait pledged more than $1.5 billion to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians. Mercado says nations are not fulfilling their pledges. Syrian refugee children in Jordan, she says, will face a bleak future if UNICEF is forced to cut back on aid because it has run out of money. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the past year, hostilities have flared between Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region and the central government in Baghdad. Attacks and bombings have increased in the disputed oil-rich city of Kirkuk, which both governments claim is their own. With tensions showing no sign of abating, many fear the violence is only going to get worse. Sebastian Meyer is following this story from Kirkuk.
4 months ago, Duz Hormatu, a sleepy town 80 kilometers southeast of Kirkuk, became the new front line between Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region and the central government. Political tensions over oil rights have flared in this disputed area, which is as rich in fossil fuels as it is in diversity. Kurds, Arabs, Turkmen, and Christians claim Kirkuk as their own. Colonel Ismail Rasul Mustafa, who is in charge of this outpost, has been a Kurdish guerrilla since 1986, when he fought for Kurdish independence from Iraq's Ba'ath regime.
We're not here to stand against the central government, but we're here to defend ourselves. If they attack us like they did before under the previous regime, we have to defend ourselves.
The city of Kirkuk, an ethnic melting pot, has seen a significant uptick in violence in the past 2 months. Bombs have targeted Shiite worshippers, Kurdish security forces, and Sunni politicians. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has warned of the danger of ethnic conflict in Iraq. But Sinan Ismail Khalil, a veteran Arab journalist, says that ethnic tensions exist only at a political level and that the real reason for the violence is oil.
It makes us laugh when we hear it's an ethnic conflict, that the disagreements are based on ethnic problems. What's the reason for all of this? Oil.
His sentiments are echoed by many of Kirkuk's residents. Ismat Lawerdi, a Christian pharmacist, says that politicians are responsible for Kirkuk's problems.
Between the people, there's no problem. Kurds, Arabs, Kurds, Assyrians, the problems with them were politicians. Mm-hmm. Yes, politicians in Baghdad. Here in Kirkuk, no difference between Arabs or Kurds or anybody.
Hussein Mohammed Hassan, from the Sunni area of Hawija, agrees that sectarian violence is solely a political tool.
Because of the politicians, we are suffering. Only brotherhood and harmony can save us.
As the violence continues, and with regional elections on the horizon, many residents of Kirkuk feel that their oil wealth is more a curse than a ticket to regional autonomy. Sebastian Meyer for VOA News, Kirkuk, Iraq.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Paul Westfeeling in Washington. More news and information on our website, MiddleEastVoices.com. That's MiddleEastVoices.com.